wonderful good morning to all of you. I'm going to be brief with my morning comments because I want to get right into our lesson. But so good to have all of you with us. Good to have the Nichols family back with us visiting. And good to have Ken and Linda and their family with us. They just celebrated, I believe, their 40th wedding anniversary. So congratulations. That's awesome. This morning we're going to talk about the second part of the second shadow of future worship. I wanted to study these back to back, that the things we talked about in the first shadow of worship, as we talk about the history of worship, would be fresh on our mind, because it's very much related to what we're going to talk about this morning in the second shadow of future worship. But I want to start in John chapter 4. If you would turn with me to John chapter 4. And as you're doing that, let's just place the context. You might remember that this is Jesus in Samaria. He has come by a well, and he's by himself. And the Samaritan woman comes to him, and he strikes up a conversation that eventually leads to this very, very debated question. And so in verse 20, she asked him this question. Our fathers worshipped in this mountain. And she's referring to a mountain called Mount Gerizim. And you people say that it is in Jerusalem is the place where men ought to worship. And Jesus said to her, woman, believe me, an hour is coming when neither in this mountain nor in Jerusalem shall you worship the Father. This passage has so much significance to what we're going to look at this morning. We often, as we look at this, we often talk about this verse here where Jesus says that it doesn't matter where you worship. That's not what it matters anymore. It's about how you worship God. And that's a great point, and it should be made here. But oftentimes, in making that point, we kind of skip the significance of verse 20, where Jesus eventually says to her, you, the Samaritans, worship that which you don't know. We, the Jews, worship that which we do know. We do know that Jerusalem is the place of worship. And Jerusalem is such a significant location. I want you to think about, to get from David, the messianic figure, David, who was the one that basically captured Jerusalem and made it the city of David, who decided to build the temple there, to get from David to Jesus is about 1,000 years. 1,000 years. That's a long period of time. I want you to think about how many people lived on the face of the earth in that time from David to Jesus. How many people came to Jerusalem to worship God, to adore themselves to Yahweh? Jerusalem was a significant city when it came to the worship of God. But in the times that we're going to talk about, as we talk about the shadows of future worship in the patriarchal period, it wasn't that significant. It wasn't even part of what God's people owned or where they lived. We talked last week about the first shadow, Melchizedek. We connected the five shadows of the five significance of Melchizedek to Christ. And we also showed that in that shadow was also a shadow of future worship, of something that we celebrate and are involved in today. And we talked about how the significance of that, well, at least one of them for us today, is that we worship Yahweh. We worship Jehovah God in the present. But we are worshiping a God that knows in detail the future and has revealed some of that to us. And I want that to play on your minds as we look at the second shadow. The second shadow, interestingly, also takes place in the days of Abraham, just like the first. It takes place much later in the life of Abraham, and I think that's significant as well. But it doesn't surprise us, because when Abraham arrives on the scene, that's where God starts telling us a lot more about the future. He starts making these promises to Abraham about the future, being brighter and more blessed, about a Savior that's coming from the seed of the woman. And so it is at this time in the life of Abraham, we see these two shadows, not just of what Abraham is doing in the present in his service and worship to God, but what worship will be in the future. He is a God that knows and a God that reveals the future. And so that second shadow that we're going to talk about today takes place, is recorded in the story of Abraham in Genesis chapter 22. If you want to begin turning there, I want to take a look at that story in Genesis chapter 22. And of course, this is the story that we're so familiar with, where Abraham is told by God to sacrifice Isaac. But I want to set the stage here. Like I said, this takes place later in the life of Abraham than the first story, the first shadow. I want you to understand that Abraham has gone through a school of faith, if you will. You remember when God started making these promises to Abraham, Abraham had to wait 25 years for these promises to be fulfilled. And in that 25 years, Abraham had to grow in faith. He had to learn to trust God. Abraham often tried to, you know, figure out things for God, tried to fulfill the promise for God. Now, the Hebrew author tells us very clearly that Abraham did not waver in unbelief. He never for a second thought that God wasn't going to do this, but he did have to learn to wait on God and to trust God. And in that 25 years, he didn't always do that so well. But now we're talking about some 35, maybe 40 years after that promise. And the promise is fulfilled, the seed promise. Isaac is born, and Abraham is enjoying this time with his son, teaching him about God, bringing his son to the altar and showing him how we sacrifice and honor God, and explaining to Isaac why they are so different than everyone around them in the land of Canaan. In other words, Abraham has reached that point in life where life is what it should be in the eyes of Abraham. All was peaceful. We are enjoying the fulfilled promise of God. He's enjoying his son Isaac. And even Sarah believes it's happier and more peaceful. Now that Hagar and Ishmael have departed from them, she doesn't like you to tell her that that was all her doing, that they were there in the first place. And so they're in this period of time where all is peaceful, all feels like the way God intended it, what God promised them, and now they're just enjoying it. Then we get to Genesis 22, and God throws him a curveball. Verse 1. Now it came about after these things that God tested Abraham. And he said to him, Abraham, and he said, here I am. And he said, take now your son, your only son, in whom you love, Isaac, and go to the land of Moriah, and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I will tell you. And so Abraham rose early in the morning. He saddled his donkey, and he took two of his young men with him, and Isaac his son, and he split wood for the burnt offering, and rose and went to the place which God had told him. And on the third day, Abraham raised his eyes, and he saw the place from a distance. And Abraham said to his young men, stay here with the donkey, and I and the lad will go over there, and we will worship and return to you. And Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering, and he laid it on Isaac his son, and he took in his hand the fire and the knife.
So the two of them walked on together. And Isaac spoke to Abraham, his father, and he said, My father. And he said, Here I am, my son. And he said, Behold the fire and the wood. But where is the lamb for the burnt offering? And Abraham said, God will provide for himself the lamb for the burnt offering, my son. And so the two of them walked on together. We know the rest of the story. Everything seems to be exactly what God wanted to be, what God promised, and now God throws him a curveball. Go sacrifice your son. The son you love, the son you've waited all these years for. Go offer him as a sacrifice. You know, sometimes God does that. We might think life is good, life is peaceful and is steady. This is what God wanted. God is blessing. Things are good. And then when that happens, oftentimes there is a curveball that is thrown to you. Sometimes it's from God. Sometimes it's simply that God allows that curveball to be in your life. And there's also another curveball, actually from Abraham. I think it's interesting that you have kind of a return to the beginning of the story of Abraham. What do you see in the beginning of the story of Abraham? You see God leading, God guiding Abraham, showing him where he wants him to be, showing him a land that he has never seen before. And so now we have God doing the exact same thing, God leading him to Moriah. I don't know if he's ever been to Moriah. I know he's been close to Moriah. But I don't know if he's ever been there. And so God is guiding him just like at the beginning of the story. But here's the difference. It's a different Abraham. In the beginning of the story, Abraham, like I said, tried to figure out things for God. And so he had a son through Hagar. And now Ishmael is his promised seed. He says, no. He said, well, one born in my house will be my promised seed. And he said, no. And he continued to try to figure things out until he finally learned, just let God do his thing. And that's the Abraham you see here. The curveball of Abraham is that, as far as it's recorded, God says, go kill your son, and without asking questions, without trying to, well, God, what if we do it this way? Or what if we do this, and trying to figure things out, making it easier, making it so we don't have to sacrifice Isaac, but yet we can appease God, fulfill everything God wants. We don't see that Abraham, he simply goes. He has learned how to trust God. He has learned not to question God, but to simply obey. And so he goes. And God leads him to Moriah, which is interesting because Moriah is very close to where the first shadow takes place. And so these two shadows not only take place both in the days of Abraham, but very close in location to one another. Remember, Melchizedek was the king of Salem. We know it as Jerusalem. Jerusalem. Now, Moriah was not part of Jerusalem at this time. The ancient city of Jerusalem was outside of Moriah, but very close to it. And so God leads him back to an area very close to where the first shadow, where he met Melchizedek. And so our second shadow also begins with an M. It is called Moriah. And just as the first shadow had connections in the patriarchal period, the Mosaic period, and the Christian age, this one does as well. And just as this has a connection to Jesus, not just worship, but the Messiah that is coming, so does this one. But as we study this story of the shadow, the shadow, for most people, seems very clear, very obvious. But there are some questions. And so we come to part of the lesson where we want to ask this question. Why Moriah. Number one, a lot of people are like, what? This doesn't make sense that God would ask a man that he loves, a man that he's made all these promises to. In fact, Isaac is part of that. Why would God have him kill his son? God isn't behaving like what we've come to know of God, a loving God. This is a God that breathed in life to mankind. Life is precious to him. This is a God later on, as we read, where Israel does sacrifice their sons in religion, not to Yahweh, but to Molech. God says it's an abomination and you're not going to do it anymore. Why would that type of God, that God, why would he say to Abraham, go sacrifice your son? You see, we often look at this story and we think about these questions. We think about what is on our mind. Well, we might have some of the answers here because we're standing so far removed. We're looking back. But I want to tell you, we are told in verse 1, part of the reason why God's doing this, it's a test. We are told it's a test, but keep in mind, Abraham is not told that. He doesn't know this is a test. He is like Job. You know, in the story of Job, you and I are privy to the conversation that God has with the devil. And how God looks at Job and why he lets Satan do the things that he does. Job never was privy to that. He didn't know what God was doing, what was on God's mind. So just because we know it's a test, Abraham does it. Another thing that sometimes we ask when we ask why Moriah is, I mean, Abraham was living in Beersheba. He had an altar right there. Why did he have to go somewhere else? Why couldn't he offer at Beersheba? And again, as we look back, we kind of have the answer to that. We know that this event is more, just more than about worshiping God. It's about the future. Abraham doesn't know that. He doesn't know Moriah is going to have this future significance that's going to change the world. And so sometimes we like to look at these stories and think what's on our mind. But to really learn from the story, it helps us if we think about what's on Abraham's mind. There's a whole lot he hasn't been told, and yet he still goes. We know it's a test. We know it's about the future. So let's connect this story of the sacrifice of Isaac to the coming Messiah. Just like the connection of Melchizedek to Jesus, let's make these connections because they're clear. In the sacrifice of Isaac, number one, you'll notice in verse 5, there is a donkey that brings the sacrifice to, not to the actual place, but close. And then they leave the donkey behind and they go rest of the way. Well, we know that Jesus rode into the place of his death. Not the exact location, but he rode on a donkey into Jerusalem. And there's a parallel there. That's a shadow. And even more so, what happens is that both Isaac the sacrifice and Jesus' sacrifice get off the donkey and they walk the rest of the way to the place of sacrifice. Another possible shadow, I don't want to force these, but isn't it interesting that as he's going to sacrifice Isaac, Abraham is accompanied by two men. As Jesus gets to the place of crucifixion, he is crucified beside two men. That might also be a part of the connection, part of the foreshadowing of the death of Jesus. You have in verse 2 and verse 12 where Jesus, or God, says to Abraham, sacrifice your only son. And someone might say, well, wait a second, what about Ishmael? Abraham had Ishmael. God's not looking at it as how many sons you really have. He's looking at it from the standpoint of promise, the standpoint of salvation. The only son that God intended for Abraham to have was Isaac. He's the fulfillment. He's the one of promise. Ishmael was all Sarah and Abraham's idea. And that's significant because over and over we are told in the New Testament that God not only sacrificed his son, it was his only son, his only begotten son. There's a connection there. And I don't know any father that would think that sacrificing any of his sons would be easier. But the idea is, well, he didn't have any other sons. He gave up the only son that he had. And that's what Abraham was asked to do. In the sacrifice of Isaac, you have in verse 4 that they arrive at least at a distance on the third day. And that's when the death takes place, or the possible death of Isaac. And of course, we know the third day is significant. There's a little difference here. In Isaac, it's the day of sacrifice. In Jesus, it's the day of resurrection. You have in the sacrifice of Isaac, verse 6, Isaac carries the wood. We know that Jesus carries his own cross at least part of the way, most of the way. You have in the sacrifice of Isaac that the ram replaced Isaac, verse 13. In the sacrifice of Jesus, Jesus replaces the sacrifice. Jesus replaces the lamb. And if you really want to look at it properly, Jesus replaces us. We're the ones that's supposed to be sacrificed. And that's the twist of this shadow that gives it so much meaning. The sacrifice of Isaac, Hebrews 11, verse 19, the Hebrew author later on, again, we get privy to this, later on tells us what was on the mind of Abraham. He tells us that Abraham believed that even if he sacrificed his son, he could, what, have him back. That God had the power to resurrect the dead. Now, how did Abraham come have that kind of faith? I mean, we sit here and we are fully assured of it, but we have other resurrections that we have heard of, that we have the evidence of. Abraham had no resurrection per se, but when you study this in light of Romans chapter 4, Abraham comes to this knowledge because he already knows Isaac was born out of dead. That he was resurrected out of the deadness of Sarah's womb and the oldness of his own loins, his own body. And Abraham figured it all out. If God can bring Isaac to birth, he can bring him back from the dead. He's already done it once. And so there is resurrection, thanks to Hebrews 11:19. And of course, the whole thing that gives this story significance and power is that Jesus doesn't stay dead, he is resurrected. In fact, the Hebrew author tells us that because that faith that Abraham had, that God could resurrect him from the dead, he says it this way, therefore he received him back as a type. The fact that he didn't have to kill Isaac, that he received him back. He brought him back alive. Another 3 days' journey is a type of resurrection in the story of the sacrifice of Isaac. In the story of the sacrifice of Isaac, Abraham didn't have to kill his son. Of course, in the story of Jesus, the Father does what Abraham didn't. He gives his son to be killed. And that's that twist. Everything fits so well until the very end, where Abraham is stopped from doing it and God goes ahead with it. That's the power, is that little twist where these things do not match but are the opposite. That's powerful. We worship a God that knows the future and plans for the future and reveals the future. The sacrifice of Jesus, we were told about long before it ever happened, even before the prophets came on the scene. It's the story of Isaac. But there's more to this than just a connection with Jesus. There is a shadow of future worship here. And it comes with the last one we want to talk about, and that is where these two sacrifices take place. They take place at the same location, or at least near the same location. Moriah becomes the very location, or again, the close proximity to the very place where Jesus goes to the cross. Now, the Romans didn't call it Moriah. They called it the place of the skull, Golgotha. But it's the same mountain, it's the same area where Isaac was put on the altar and yet was spared. And to even give the more significance to the location, because of all that happened in the story of Isaac, Abraham calls the place, he calls the very location, "The Lord will provide."
Man, did he ever provide. He provided his own lamb, the perfect lamb.
And it was all at the same place where Isaac was spared in return as a type. So let's finish with this. How Moriah? We asked why Moriah. Let's talk about how Moriah. What do we mean by that? Well, how does Moriah come to be in the possession of God's people? How does it come to be that place where Jesus is going to die and be the perfect sacrifice? You see, it becomes important as to how this comes about, because Moriah stays outside the possession of God's people. In the days of Joshua, they are not able to take possession of Moriah. They are not able to take possession of Jerusalem. It stays possessed by the Jebusites. It's never in their possession. All the days after Joshua, it is still occupied by the Jebusites. All the days of King Saul, the Jebusites have it, not Israel. In the first part of David's 7.5 years of king, it's still by the Jebusites. But finally, David takes over Jerusalem, defeats it, and he makes it his home. And one day he decides to build a house, a temple for God. But you know what? God says no. So he says, Solomon will build my house. But you know what? David makes all the plans. But Moriah is not part of Jerusalem, even in the days of David. As David is ruling, it's not part of Jerusalem. It doesn't come to be part of Jerusalem until we get to this interesting story in 2 Samuel. Turn with me, if you would, 2 Samuel chapter 24. This is the story where David, towards later on as a king, later on in his kingdom, he makes God angry by taking a census of all the people. He counts them. And even his general Joab knows, you shouldn't be doing this, David. But David's the king, and so Joab does it. David is not like Abraham in this story. He is not faithful. He is not trusting God. He's doing what he wants. And so God comes to him and says, David, why did you do that? Why did you think that you had to count the people? How many times have your people won victory and it didn't matter how many soldiers you had? David had forgotten the story of Gideon, where God reduced the size of the army. He forgot all the times where it wasn't about how many soldiers you had, but that you had God. And so God says to him, I'm going to give you your choice. You select your punishment out of three choices. And so he says there's going to be a mild punishment, but it's going to be long. There's going to be a medium type of plague come upon you, and it's going to be kind of a medium type of time period. And then he offers him option three, a severe plague. A severe punishment that would last a short period of time, 3 days. And eventually it's the third option that gets selected. And so David, as you'll notice in chapter 24 and in verse 15, the Lord sent a pestilence upon Israel from morning until the appointed time. And 70,000 men of the people from Dan to Beersheba died. David goes outside to see the punishment. 70,000 people die because of David's sin. And David finally says to God, enough is enough. I'm the guilty one. Kill me, not them. Stop this. And the angel of death comes. And he's about ready to go into Jerusalem and destroy Jerusalem, to bring this pestilence upon Jerusalem. And God says to the angel of death, stop. Stop. And he tells David, if you will build an altar and offer burnt offerings to me and appease me, I will stop the killing. Now, where God tells him to make this sacrifice in this chapter, it's not called Moriah. Moriah is known here as the threshing floor, and it's named after the man that owns it, Arona. He's a Jebusite. A Jebusite still owns Moriah. He's using it as a threshing floor. And so David runs down to Arona and he says, let me buy this land so that I can sacrifice to God and I can appease God and I can stop this. And Arona honors David. And he says, just take the land. In fact, I have two ox that are working for me. Take those and sacrifice those to God, and you owe me nothing. And look at verse 24. However, the king said to Arona, no, but I will surely buy it from you for a price. For I will not offer burnt offerings to the Lord my God, which cost me nothing. So David bought the threshing floor and the oxen for 50 shekels of silver. And David built there an altar to the Lord and offered burnt offerings and peace offerings. And thus the Lord was moved by prayer for the land, and the plague was held back from Israel. That's how Moriah comes to be in the possession of David. Now I want you to look just at the shadows of this story. You've got one man guilty of sin and everyone else is dying. In the story of Jesus, you have an innocent man and everyone else is sinning. He dies. I want you to notice as well, to stop the killing, God says there needs to be a sacrifice. But it has to be at a price. David says, I'm not going to do it if it costs me nothing. And so all this takes place at the same location where Jesus becomes the perfect price for the sins of all others. There's a twist to the shadow. But again, it's the location as well. Jesus stopped death's power. Jesus stopped the killing by dying at the same place. And to even give more power to this, when David decides to build the temple, even though he's not allowed to build it, he makes the selection of where to put the temple. And more importantly, where this altar is going to be, where Israel is going to sacrifice thousands and millions of animals. In 2 Chronicles chapter 3 and verse 1, Solomon began to build the house of the Lord in Jerusalem on Mount Moriah, where the Lord had appeared to his father David, and the place that David had prepared on the threshing floor of Ornan the Jebusite. That's just another rendition of his name, Ornan. Same one. And so this becomes Jerusalem. This becomes the place of worship. This becomes the place where Israel, year after year, generation after generation, appeases God and stops the killing. Where they receive the grace and the forgiveness of God. But there is still sacrifice. So what have we learned in this lesson? We've learned in Genesis chapter 22 that what happened is so significant, but not just what happened, where it happened. Where it happened points us to the future. What happened looks as a shadow to what is to come. Then we looked at the Mosaic period in 2 Samuel chapter 24, where it not only becomes the possession of God's people, but where it stopped the killing of lives by David's sacrifice. Not just what happens becomes significant, but where it happens. And eventually we have the full shadow, that we have the reality where Jesus is fully shown. Mark 15, verse 22. He comes to Moriah, to Golgotha, and he dies. But that's not the end of the story. It's what happens and where it happens. Just like Isaac, Jesus is resurrected to a new life. And so when you look at John chapter 4, verse 20, 21, yes, let's talk about how it's not the place that we worship. That we could worship in this wonderful building, or we could worship at a school building, or we could worship at someone's house. But what makes all of that possible is what happened at Moriah. What happened at Jerusalem, which long before it ever happened, God showed us where and what would happen. We worship a God that knows and plans and controls the future. And if that doesn't get you motivated and excited to bow your knee and to kiss Him in worship to God, I don't know what will. May God help us to praise and bless Him with our lives and our worship. Take a songbook, if you would. Turn to the Song of Invitation. If there is one that has not been serving God and praising God with all their heart, let's change that this morning. If there is one that has not become obedient and baptized themselves in the waters of baptism, looking for the forgiveness of sins, not as a sign of salvation, but as part of that process of being saved, let's take care of that this morning. If you're in need of doing any of that, and we can help you, let that be known as together we stand and as we sing.